This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, beginning an oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel Alan J. Lavelle. Today's date is the 5th of May, 2004, and both Al and I are here in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech. Well, good afternoon, Al.
Good afternoon, Dr. Calkins.
I would like to begin just by asking you when and where you were born, and maybe you could tell me something about your childhood.
Well, I was born in 1920 in Denver, Colorado. But I must tell you, my father and mother were married in Leadville, and they headed for a town called Climax, where they spent their first night, and where I think I was conceived.
That would make sense.
And they traveled all down to Natarita, where my dad was ostensibly an engineer in the mines. And in those days, the mines were producing pitchblende, from which they extracted radium, which was needed back then. Later on in the same area, they found a trash ore called uranium, which nobody wanted, and the town became a ghost town. But I started out life in Colorado. My grandfather, who was a doctor, insisted my mother return to civilization, at least to give birth to me. So I was born in Denver. But shortly after being born, I was taken down to southwestern Colorado, to Natarita. Little Joe Jr. Mine. It was a mine that, as I told you, mined pitchblende, and mostly they were Irish miners. So it was kind of an Irish mining camp.
Okay.
And I guess I spent maybe 6 years there, and then my father, who eventually became an electrical engineer, began looking for better jobs, and we moved all around the country as he, not because he was a will-o'-the-wisp, but because he was ambitious and looking for something better, moved us from Colorado to the state of Maine. From the state of Maine to Chicago, where the Great Depression caught him and where he lost all his money like so many people did.
Sure.
We went back to Colorado for a couple of years, and then my father reconnected again, and we moved to Pennsylvania. So I grew up as a teenager in Pennsylvania on the Philadelphia Main Line.
Yes.
A very nice part of the world, where actually people lived just about the way people do in suburbia today, except we didn't have TV. But other than that, I had a rather prosaic childhood.
Now, did your father ever have military service?
He was in the National Guard, but never served overseas. But he got interested. He had a lot of friends that were in the National Guard, and he got interested in flying back in about 1926. And used to take me out to Lowry Field, where in those days it was just a grass field, but he had a lot of buddies that flew in the National Guard and the Reserve, and I became acquainted with airplanes. My poor father wanted to learn to fly, but he was too busy supporting me and my mother. But it was something he always wanted to do.
Now, were there other children as well, or just you, Al?
No, I have three sisters and I have a brother named Mike, and I'm 26 years older than Mike.
Oh, really?
Under the same mother. And so I have three sisters and a brother still. They're all hale and hearty, still alive.
Really? And you were the oldest then?
I'm the oldest. I'm the oldest of 18 grandchildren, too. And as a matter of fact, I come from a large Irish clan, and I'm the oldest member of the clan, and today I'm the patriarch of that clan.
You're the patriarch
I'm
now.
I'm the patriarch.
Do they all listen to you then?
We have gatherings every couple of years. Oh, yes. As long as you're not senile, they'll listen to you. And, of course, there's a big event. He's always telling stories, which we all love to do. And when I was young, my grandfather and my father and his sisters, they all kept up a round robin of correspondence. They were great writers, and they entertained one another, tried to outdo one another writing. And that's why, even today, I'd rather write a letter than do anything.
And you're a very good writer. We have some of your material.
Well, everything I have is rough. I have nothing that's really polished like you'd have to present to a publisher, but I just love to write. And I'll write to anybody about anything, anytime.
Wonderful. It's a dying art. It's been superseded in so many different ways by the cell phone and the telephone, of course.
Yes.
Al, tell me about your mother.
My mother was named Mary Scholastica McDonald. Her father was a doctor in Leadville, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
He was a chief doctor and surgeon at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, I believe. And my mother, it seemed to me, always had illusions of grandeur because she was the doctor's daughter.
I see.
But her mother died when my mother was probably about 12 years old. And my mother was sent to boarding school, Loretta Heights Academy, where she became a very proficient violinist and played professionally. And to this one day, she met this young guy named Jack Lavelle, my father. And because he was such a handsome guy, such a lovely dancer.
Aha. That works.
There was an attraction, and they married, and I guess I was the happy result.
Mm-hmm. Now, did your dad go to formal schooling as
an
engineer?
My dad went to college for 2 years in Boulder.
Okay.
And then he finished up by international correspondence school. Mm-hmm. And at one time, a lot of people would look down their nose at that kind of a degree, but I found out since it's harder doing that than is going to college. But he was a very proficient engineer and worked as a graduate engineer all the rest of his life and obtained jobs because he was a good engineer.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell anything about the pitch blend, the industry? What was it being used for? Do you know?
Well, a pitch blend is an accumulation of fossil trees.
Okay.
You can actually see the trees in the rock strata. And this was during the period when Madame Curie
mm-hmm.
Helped develop the industry. And Madame Curie and her husband supposedly went down to Nattery and my mother entertained them. Not very lavishly because they lived in typical miners' homes with wooden walls up to about eye level and then with a canvas roof. But my mother entertained them with dinner and a violin and water. She often talked about meeting Madame Curie.
Madame Curie did go on a tour of the United States at some point.
Yeah, I guess that was when she met him.
Yeah.
And then, as I told you, later they found this uranium, which nobody wanted. And the town became a ghost town. Until World War II, when uranium was wanted by industry, and the town boomed again, but again it has died.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's the only people you see up there are big game hunters, because there's still a lot of elk and bear, I guess. But the whole area is polluted now, I'm told.
Now this is Leadville area?
No, this is down around Nuclea, Colorado.
Okay.
There's a town called Natarita, Nuclea, and I forget the name of the other town, but it's about 86 miles south of Grand Junction.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Very scenic area, but it would be hard to earn a living there, I know.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about your schooling. Where did you actually graduate from high school, I guess? Was it in Philadelphia or the Philadelphia area?
Philadelphia Main Line, St. Catherine's High School.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What year?
1936, I believe.
And what kind of student were you, Al?
Well, first of all, I was always educated by the Irish nuns.
Yes, yes.
And I was an A student in everything except math.
Really?
And I just hated math. And years later, when I went off to... Well, first of all, my dad wanted me to go to college right out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want it. I wanted to get out and work for a while, but he insisted I go. And I was afraid to even apply because I failed algebra 4 times. 70 was passing. I used to make grades like 12, 13, whatnot. But I had this dear old Irish nun. I went to see her and said, "Sister Rita Josephine, I'd like to go to college." "Dan, sure, you should go to college. You're a bright boy." I said, "But I failed algebra 4 times. I took it 1 year and then took the summer school and failed. Took it the second year and failed. Okay. Took it the 4th time. Highest grade I ever made was 28. And the teacher wrote across the top of the page, "Much improvement. Keep up the good work." And I came home and I said, Dad, you know, I really think I'm getting the hang of this algebra. He says, "Thank God." And I says, "Let me see that paper." "Oh, for Christ's sake, 28? Jesus, Mary, and so forth." Anyway, I was a good student except for math. Later on, when I go to tell my sister Rita Josephine, she said, "Well, you know, if you get down on your knees and pray, you know, miracles can happen. And she said, will you do that? And I said, yes. And I guess I did a time or two, but I applied for Penn State. Mm-hmm. And I found out later that not only did I finish algebra and geometry, I was up for third of the class.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, took care of that.
Yeah. Anyway, my concept of college in those days, I'd go through the catalog and try to find out which of those courses didn't have any math.
No math.
Yeah.
Right.
And I picked the worst course in the world. I don't know how I did it, but I picked a course called Agricultural Education. It was designed for boys who came from big prosperous farms to go back and manage their farms.
Uh-huh.
And I took a course called Mensuration, which is the measurement of the number of board feet in a forest. And even seeds and feeding was nothing but math to me. And I did very miserably. I didn't fail the year, but I flunked several courses. My dad wasn't too happy with me. And then the following year, I went to St. Joseph's in Philadelphia. And there, I was doing fine, except that I guess by this time, somebody knew that World War II was in the offing, and they decided to offer pilot training to kids in college who were qualified.
Yes.
And I was offered a chance to become a pilot in the CPT program. They only selected five people from my college, and I was one of them. And so anyway, after my second year of college, I had my private pilot license, and by then I got really into flying. With a couple other guys, I bought an old airplane and got enough time for what they call a limited commercial license, where I could fly for hire within 50 miles of my home and build up more time.
Uh-huh.
And so over a period of time, I got quite a bit of time for that day and age. Eventually, I got my commercial license.
About when would that have been, Al?
This is probably about 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And I was touted as being one of the youngest commercial pilots in the United States, and I think I was. And I somehow made connections with a guy who owned Aero Service Corporation, the Aero Mapping and Surveying.
Yeah.
And I got a job with them. I flew with them until World War II came along, and then I went into the Navy, became a Navy pilot.
Al, there's a couple of things in there I want to ask you a little bit about. First of all, when did you first start flying? Do you remember Lindbergh and Lindbergh's flight?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, this is 1927.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And everybody in the country, not just people in our school, were on pins and needles. We all wondering what happened to Lindbergh.
Uh-huh.
And when word came down finally that he landed in Paris, why, everybody in the school just went wild with excitement. I don't think we got the day off, but the rest of the day was kind of, you know, talking about Lindbergh.
Sure.
And a few months later, when Lindbergh made his tour of the United States, I think it was on August 14th, he flew into Denver, and my dad and I were parked at the end of the runway. And in those days, Lowry Field was just a big grass field, and cars were parked everywhere except on the runway itself. And Lindbergh came in. He had a crosswind. He was crabbing his airplane into the wind. Nobody knew anything about flying. He was just, you know, heading into the wind to keep his track
sure.
on the ground straight.
Yep.
And look at that. He can fly an airplane sideways. Not everybody can do that. No. Anyway, he put the airplane in the hangar, and there was just a rope across the hangar, and people were up there gawking at the airplane. He was wiping off the grease and whatnot. And he came over and shook a few hands, one of which was mine. And I was so proud of the fact that this hand, you know, shook the hand of Lindbergh, and for a few days I was, you know, the hero of my neighborhood.
I bet you were a star.
Yeah, I remember that very vividly.
Do you remember him, how he looked that day?
Oh, yes.
Can you describe, what was he wearing? What did he...
He was wearing kind of like khaki knickers
uh-huh.
with kind of leather, not spats, but leather. Well, I really forget what he was wearing, but he dressed like many of the aviators dressed in those days. He had on a white jacket, and in khaki clothes, and I think he had on a white shirt and a tie. He looked very presentable.
Was he a hero to you?
Oh, he was a hero to the whole world. Absolutely, yes. And I think shortly thereafter, I decided I, too, was going to follow in his footsteps. I was living in Colorado, as I mentioned. And there was a place called Inspiration Point where the young lovers would park their cars at night and engage in God knows what. But there's a steep hill there. And I got thinking, I wonder if I could put wings on my bicycle and build a takeoff place on that hill and fly over the valley and wave at all the girls. And I had one cousin who was just putty in my hands. His name was Dick Linsenmeyer. All of my cousins were Irish and had Irish mothers and Irish fathers, but Dick's father's name was Fritz Linsenmeyer.
So he was a good German, yeah?
Oh, yeah. We call him Protestant Dick. or Dickie the Pea, I think we called him. Anyway, Dickie the Pea was putty in my hands.
Uh-huh.
And he could work, he was clever with his hands. And anything I'd want to do, why, he was there to help me. Well, we stole some sheets out of my mother's linen closet, and we stole some light lath that they used to use, light wood they used to use to put plaster on,
mm-hmm.
and wires and whatnot. And we put wings on the bicycle and built an outrigger and put a rudder and tail on it. Had the handlebars hooked to the rudder, and of course, didn't have any elevators, and things all out of balance and whatnot. But it looked pretty good to us. And then we spent a week or more stealing railroad ties and lumber, and we'd drag them over up to Inspiration Point, and we built for all practical purposes, it was a ski jump.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew that when I hit that ski jump, I was going to be a second Lindbergh. And I remember Dick and I had a little spat at the top of the hill. He wanted to go first, and I was a little bit bigger than him and with my bike, so I got to go first. I shoved off over the hill, and immediately I'd reached terminal velocity for whatever bicycle it is for a bicycle. I couldn't even put my feet on the pedal. And I hit the ski jump, one wing dragging. What I did, I went out 50 feet in the air and stalled.
I mean, I'm laughing, but it was probably...
Yeah, well, but I think the mass of those wings on it kind of slowed me down.
Mm-hmm.
I fell to the bottom and rolled, and the bicycle and the wings and it all wrapped around me. I was hurt, but not seriously. I should have been killed.
How far a drop?
I'd say I dropped 35 feet and hit the bottom of the hill and kept rolling. But, you know, kids are pretty pliable and whatnot.
Right.
So that was the end of my bicycle.
Yeah.
And years later, I went to Colorado with my kids. And my kids never quite believed this story, but my cousin Dick, who was alive then, came out to Inspiration Point with me. And I said, Dick, tell Tony about what we did here. And he told her the story as essentially what I told you. And years later, when she was in Hawaii, she had somebody who was handy with her hands build a little model of that bicycle with wings on it, which I still have in my,
really?
In my study.
Commemorating your great adventure.
Yeah, but I remember Lindbergh, and he had a big impact on kids my age.
Sure, absolutely.
About every guy I ever met in the Air Force was influenced by Lindbergh.
Mm-hmm.
And just a few years ago, I was in Hawaii, and I went out to visit his grave. Now, he was buried in Hawaii.
I didn't know that, no.
And he was alienated from his kids.
Yes.
But in the last few years, months of his life, he became well acquainted with his kids, and they dug a grave, and he's buried in Haleakala Crater on Maui.
Mm-hmm.
But I went up to his grave, and I was on a tour bus that was fitted up to make that journey because it was tough. You needed four-wheel drive to do it.
I believe it.
I was surprised to learn that half the people on the bus didn't even remember who Lindbergh was.
Well, I noted that you had written just a brief piece about him, and I wondered what role he had played, and that you met him is fabulous.
I've been disappointed in him. I thought he and Ann Morrow Lindbergh were the ideal husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was miserable. He couldn't stand being at home. He wanted the world just to keep away from home responsibility. He had another family in Germany. don't know if you know, heard about that.
I have heard that.
And
I didn't know it was true.
Anne was the mistress of St. Anne's Saint-Exupéry, the famous pilot and poet.
Really?
Yeah. Plus a doctor in New York. And this is all...
Quite a lot going on there.
Yeah, this is all well known, so mm-hmm. I'm not snitching on it.
Sure, sure.
But I admired Anne for her own accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't look upon them as an ideal for a married couple to aspire to.
Right, and they had problems that weren't of their creating as well.
And they had the wonderful kids too. Their son John became a world famous oceanographer and diver. And they got another one who was as famous as an animal nutritionist. And they were worthwhile people.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, and a very important influence on America in the time we're talking about. Tell me about your first successful flight. When did you begin to actually fly in airplanes?
When I was in college at Penn State,
mm-hmm.
I took lessons in a Ronca C-3. It was a little high-wing monoplane with a two-cylinder engine, about 37 horsepower.
Yeah.
It has this huge wing. It was more like a glider than an airplane.
Uh-huh.
But you could take off, two adults could take off in it, and get the feel of flight. You learned a lot about thermals because it's very sensitive to air currents and whatnot. And you could wheel and fly with the buzzards and the hawks, and it was very exciting. Even when you fly over a plowed field in the summer, the heat from the field, I'd fly over a washboard and massage your back.
Really?
And then I flew in what they call an old biplane with an OX-5 motor. OX-5 motors were made during World War I. They're water-cooled, about 90 horsepower, and they're very cheap on the surplus market. And
mm-hmm.
Most of the old planes had that engine. So that's the kind of plane I started flying in. And then I got in the CPT program just before World War II and got my commercial license and went to work for Aero Service Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was with Aero Service Corporation, I had a very unfortunate accident. And it wasn't my fault. The boss sent me over to... first of all, it became the largest aerial mapping outfit in the world.
Yes. What kind of work did you do for them, Al, before you tell about the accident?
What kind of work did...
Yeah, what were you doing?
Well, I was a grease monkey.
What does that mean?
That means I greased the rocker arms and put gas and oil in the airplanes. With the promise that I'd get a lot of flying time.
Uh-huh.
I did. But I did a lot of greasy work, too. But I eventually got a lot of flying time. And, and initially, I flew a small airplane with a door off with a camera mounted. I would fly to highway intersections or housing developments or industrial sites and bank by banking and taking the camera. I'd use the camera and take pictures. They call oblique pictures.
Yes.
Oblique angle.
Yes.
I did that here, there, and everywhere. I got to a lot of interesting places.
What were they using those photographs for? Were they selling them to the places that a photograph might have been taken?
They did a lot of work for the government too, photographing farmlands and whatnot.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But, and highway intersections and they had a lot of orders.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was being trained for high altitude work, and I ferried airplanes here and there, and got to fly some of the bigger airplanes I had. But the boss sent me over one day to fly old number one. He had a store on a farm in New Hope, Pennsylvania. Yeah, but he loved this. He had oil paintings in his office and models and pictures of him standing by. He just loved that old airplane. Been sitting in the barn for 2 years, and it was full of bird droppings and mice had gotten in the wings.
Sure.
And whatnot. But we cleaned up as best we could, and they had a mechanic named Bob Scott that was new to the company. He came out with me, and we started the thing up, and it ran fine. He said, "Okay, Red, it's okay, take off." And I said, "Okay," and I took off. And I flew down. They mowed the runway down for the week, and there are big cherry trees down there, and I got over them, and the engine stopped. And I had no place to go down except in this tomato field. And to keep from going into a gully, I ground looped it, and I just took out an awful lot of tomatoes. They eventually got in there with a row crop tractor and towed me out. And fortunately, this airplane had folding wings. They were talking about cutting down some of the trees, but you know, we folded the wing. We got back in the wheat field and tried to start the engine and start it right up. And this mechanic said, "I'll tell you what's wrong with it." He said, "You notice that little tip on the primer is broken off, and you couldn't lock the primer, and the engine flooded out." And so he broke off a straw and stuck it in there and jammed it. And he said, "That's okay now." Well, years later, when I was flying Navy planes, I tried to, when I was taxiing, I'd take the primer and try to flood. You can flood an engine out when it's idling, but yes, when it's running at full power, you can't.
Right.
Anyway, he says, "Okay." I took off, and this time I cleared the cherry trees, and the engine stopped again, and there's no place to go except down. And there's a gully with trees in it, and I purposely tried to hit the ground before I hit the gully, and my landing gear came up to the fuselage and tore out the seat I was sitting in, the back of the seat, and was sliding on its nose and belly through these trees, which were slowing me up, but I still hit the side of the gully with such force it pitched me through the cabane struts. I came out, my head was actually between the cylinders. And I had this big stick. You get a big stick like a baseball bat. But when I hit, I came to a stop, it kind of acted like a fulcrum, but it dug into my chest and into my throat. I couldn't talk for the rest of the day. And I was stunned. And I heard that Scotty and the other guys coming over on the track. Rip, you're alive, Rip. Well, I was alive, but I was so mortified that I left the company. Well, I think I had a letter in one of those things I gave you.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Kaufman wasn't mad at me at all. And found out later it was not my fault. That airplane, they just gave me enough gas in the center tank to get from where I was to where I was going, which is about 25 miles. And in those old planes, the gas outlet was about the middle of the tank. When you're climbing like this, if the tank wasn't full, the airplane didn't get gas.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have outlets here, both front and back. Not only that, they found that mud daubers had clogged the air vent in the gas tank. So they build mud. Put
a mud wasp?
Yeah,
plank.
They think I might have got a vapor lock from the mud daubers.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty should have caught that. I didn't have enough knowledge to know all these things, but anyway, I left the company and went in the Navy, and the war started.
Now, Al, I'm going to ask you about that maybe tomorrow morning, but I wonder if you have memories of being in air shows.
Yes.
Remember flying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That'd be great if you could tell us anything about how those were organized and what you did.
They weren't organized at all. I was known as Wild Red Lavelle.
Okay, and Wild Red.
And Wild Red taught himself how to do slow rolls and spins and loops and emulations. And I didn't, but with no great precision. Later on, I learned how to be a real, you know, precision pilot.
Mm-hmm.
I should have been called Lucky Lavelle, because.
Uh-huh.
And every time there was an air show, somebody would contact old Wild Red, and I'd come over there and put on my demonstration and never wore a parachute. Now you have to adhere to all rules and regulations. But I flew in a lot of air shows where I just took off and flew.
It was just a wide open thing where no rules really. You could go up and do what you wanted.
No, the only time I remember getting in trouble, I flew a guy. That's when I worked with this company. There's a guy named Ed Canfield who was touted as being the world's champion coyote and hawk killer, I guess. And he used to go up in an airplane and release about 12 balloons. And then with a shotgun, come down and hit all the balloons. And I was the pilot. You know, I'd go after the balloons, and he had a shotgun that held six cartridges, I guess. And we'd go after the balloons, and one time the last few balloons were I guess shooting into the crowd. And somebody got on us for that.
Yeah, I would think.
But I used to come down and cut ribbons with my wheels and do all sorts of things. As a matter of fact, when that video tape you're going to look at,
mm-hmm.
just before you get to Vietnam, It was a yellow plane. That's the last air show I flew in up here to Georgetown.
Here in Texas?
Yeah, that was probably back in 1974.
So you were still...
I was flying acrobatics until the year before last. I was just married to Margarita.
Yes.
And I'd ordered this acrobatic plane, one that I always wanted. And it finally arrived. And just so I could get her out of the way, so I could have 2 weeks of getting reacquainted with my airplane,
mm-hmm.
I sent her on a trip out to California to meet my sister. Well, she knew my sister. Anyway, she was out there, and I took off. I'll send you the report on this.
Okay, great.
And it wasn't my fault because an FAA guy was watching what happened, and plus the airport operator.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I've owned a lot of airplanes. This is the only one I had insurance on, and I made one payment. The payment was for about one-third of the year. It was very expensive.
Sure.
But I had insurance. Anyway, I took off in this neat little acrobatic airplane. When Margarita saw it, she thought it was a toy. I mean, it was so small, you know, you can touch the ends of the wings and touch the tail. And it was a very calm day, but there had been storms the night before, and some of the pilots were complaining about dust devils. And some of them are pretty big,
mm-hmm.
like a small tornado.
For sure.
Anyway, they'd torn up the runway, and I was using the taxiway, which is 6,000 feet long, plenty long, but there's road machinery on either side of tractors and earth movers and whatnot. But I checked the windsock, and it was hanging limp. I swung out on the runway, and as I did, a dust devil picked up behind me and was following the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, I was doing about 60 miles an hour, doing quite well. But then this dust devil enveloped me, and with a rush of wind over the air, I picked the airplane up, and I found the airplane. I wanted to keep it headed down the runway, but the dust devil was making it difficult for me to keep my track over the ground, and I applied more power, and I was trying to climb. Well, to make a long story short, the dust devil quickly enveloped me and passed over me, but left me high and dry. I really wasn't flying, and the airplane spun over the top into the ground, and I was doing about 60 miles an hour. Just tore it all to hell.
What about you?
I was banged up. There was a transponder that dug into my leg, but I had a tight safety belt and shoulder harness, and I was black and blue for weeks, but a lot. And it didn't go upside down. If it had done that, it had a fiberglass tank that leaked to begin with, but I mean, I would have been incinerated. But that was the end of that.
Well, Al, so just in the time...
But I still have an airplane.
You have one now?
I'm part owner of one. Yes,
okay,
yeah.
And you're still actively flying?
Not actively. I fly a bit? Not quite a bit, no. Now and then. I have this young guy. I met him when he was 16 years old. His name is Matt Vanderwaller from a prominent farm family in San Antonio. I taught him to fly, and I taught him aerobatics. He went on to become the chief pilot at Kelly. He's the chief C-5A pilot.
Okay.
He's a great pilot, but he also loves small airplanes, and we fly together now. And I recently bought two more airplanes at an estate sale. I don't know whether they're junk or whether they're worth anything. I haven't retrieved them yet, but I still mess around with them. But I probably shouldn't.
but you've owned your own planes for...
Many.
Yeah, and you bought and sold them as time went by.
In my lifetime, I've owned about 20. I've owned as many as two at a time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time I was in Vietnam. This drove my wife crazy. I was paying hangar rent on two airplanes all the time I was in Vietnam. And she just kind of got incoherent when she thought about it.
Now, this is your first wife that we're talking about. And what year did you marry her?
I married her in 1945.
Okay, so right at the end of the war.
We were married 54 years.
And what was her name?
Grace Beatrice Mankin.
Where was she? How do you spell that?
M-A-N-C-I-N.
K-I-N. And she was from Texas?
She was from northeast Texas. A very lovely girl from a farm family, cotton family. And she's a wonderful wife and mother.
Yes, of course. You left Aero Service Corps,
yes,
after that crash.
Yeah.
Did you think that you would fly again, or did you?
No, I immediately enlisted in the Navy and became a Navy pilot.
Okay. Tell me about enlisting. What year did that happen?
It was right after Pearl Harbor.
So Pearl Harbor had happened.
That sent me into the Navy.
Al, tell me what you remember about the first time you heard about Pearl Harbor and what happened. Where were you?
I was with Aero Service Corporation when I heard about it. And I was in a movie in Philadelphia with Bob Scott, the mechanic I mentioned, and it was flashed on the screen.
Really?
Yeah. And now we're at war with the Japs, and everybody gets kind of excited about that.
You had already been at that point in the civilian pilot training program,
mm-hmm,
and you said there were a couple of other guys, I guess from St. Joe's, who
mm-hmm
also got in. And one of those men was killed right around this time. Is that right?
Well, we eventually got killed. The first one was named Jim Bedlock, and this is interesting.
Yes.
He was an Italian boy. His original name was Bedlocano.
Okay.
We were both on the boxing team at St. Joe, and I knew him very well.
Mm-hmm.
And he went in the old Army Air Corps, and he was flying P-40s.
Okay.
And he got killed the second day after, the day after Pearl Harbor, and he was shot down by Salvador Sakai, the leading Japanese ace, who I knew very well. I met and got to know him very well.
Oh,
and I talked to Salvador about
that
day he shot down my friend Bedlock. He was taken off from Clark Field on P-40, and Salvador, who had been flying for years in China with a superb pilot, came in and just knocked him out of the sky. And the way I met Salvador Sakai,
mm-hmm,
when I was a teacher, I was in charge of the foreign students. A lot of them were Japanese.
Now, about when would this have been?
Well, I started teaching school in 74, I guess.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And one of the girls was named Michiko Sakai, but I never put two and two together. But she finished high school and matured and went on to college, and she went to a fine college there in San Antonio, and she used to often invite me to some of the parties that foreign students had.
Sure.
And of course by this time she was quite a young lady and whatnot. And I said to her one day, "Michiko, did you ever hear a guy named Salvador Sakai?" She said, "I guess I have. It's my daddy." I said, "I heard about him in World War II." I said, "Yeah," and I thought I'd love to meet him sometime. And she said, "Well, you can. He comes out here to Fredericksburg every year where they have a meeting of the Japanese and American World War II aces or people who fought
sure
one another."
Sure.
Anyway, by this time, I mean, this sounds unbelievable. Here, there's a comedy on TV called Get Smart.
Yes.
Remember that?
Sure do.
Let me get this story straight now. Anyway, Michiko married an American Army captain whose name was Smart. And what was the name of the guy that played Don? Anyway, she named her baby
After the star of the
after
show?
After the star. Anyway.
Oh, boy. I can't quite call it up, but I know Don something, I think.
Anyway.
We'll think of it.
Yeah.
So she
and it just so happened that 2 weeks before that, my youngest daughter. Now, I spent a lot of time in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
12 years, I guess. And I knew a lot of American men that had Japanese wives and girlfriends and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew any American girl that married a Japanese man, but my youngest daughter did.
Is that right?
And she married a guy by the name of Mitsuyuki Miyazaki.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Michiko introduced me to her daddy, Sakai, and she was talking in Japanese. I said, "Michiko, I can speak pretty good Japanese. Let me talk to your daddy in Japanese." And so we talked in Japanese, which impressed him.
Yes.
Anyway, I said to him, "Isn't it strange, Mr. Sakai, when you were raised in the spirit of Bushido, you are a samurai warrior, and your youngest daughter, Michiko, married an American named Smart, and you have a baby name. I forget the name of the baby."
Yeah.
And I said, "And just 2 weeks ago, my youngest daughter married a guy named Miyazaki. And he said, "Oh gosh, you know, I tell you all, which means good and strange world, isn't it?" But anyway, he was Japan's leading ace.
Yes.
He weighed about, I'd say, 98 pounds, bald, one eye.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't look very formidable. But in World War II, if he get on your tail, you're a dead meat. He was a great pilot.
Did you ask him about that day at Clark Field?
Oh, yeah. And I asked him. I said, I had a friend. And I told him the story I essentially told. He said, "Yeah, that was me. I remember it very vividly." He said that before he was taken off, and I nailed him.
Was that tough for you?
No, not really. Well, these things, you know, I...
You had already...
Years had passed and whatnot, mm-hmm. But... God knows how many other people he knocked out of the sky, but that's what he did.
Sure.
And he was good at it.
Do you remember some of those other guys that were in that training?
Oh, yeah. A guy by the name of Dahlenberg. Fred Dahlenberg.
Uh-huh.
Dahlenberg was a big man on campus in college.
Uh-huh.
And during World War II, he made quite a name for himself flying B-24s, I think. And he had a wife who was in the newspaper business who gave him a lot of publicity.
Good, uh-huh.
And so I read about Dahlenberg for years after World War II, and he started a business called Wing Cargo, which ostensibly was to tow cargo gliders from the United States and Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
I think they tried it a time or two and didn't work out too well. And then they just had the Wing Cargo Transport Company. And what they were doing back then were transporting Puerto Ricans from Puerto Rico to New Jersey.
Why?
Where they worked on the Seabrook farms, and then in the wintertime went to New York where they became a problem for the relief people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But Dahlenberg died, a natural death, I think. And there were a couple other guys that started flying, but they all got killed during World War II.
Most of them were lost during World War II. And the purpose of that pilot training program, that civilian pilot training program, was
get a nucleus of people who are vaguely familiar with flying and push them through to further training.
Anticipating a conflict.
That's where the pilots came from, mostly. Yeah.
Yeah. And in those years, right before Pearl Harbor, say 1940 and 41, were you paying attention to world events? Were you watching?
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, I was a typical young person.
Young man.
Couldn't see the forest for the trees, and all I wanted to do was fly airplanes. When I was young, I was so stupid and non-political that even after World War II, another guy and I tried to get a job flying with the Jews or the Arabs, whoever pay us the most, you know, that sort of nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And we got offers from both of them, but we couldn't pin them down to the exact amount, and then went off to do something else, but... No, I was non-political, and I was non-knowledgeable about most everything.
So when you were in that movie house and the news about the attack on Pearl Harbor flashed up there, that must have been an amazing shock.
Not a shock. Oh, good war.
Oh, good war?
Yeah. When you're young and dumb, I wasn't concerned about the horrible aspects of what was going to follow, and I just, fly more airplanes, more places now. Drop more bombs, and I guess one of the biggest in the letters that you wrote, you're always asking me about my military career, and I kept trying to tell you my military career was not spectacular. I was a pilot, and I wanted to get out in the Pacific and kill Japanese like every young and dumb guy did.
Mm-hmm.
But because I had so much experience for that day and age, I was always retained as an instructor. And eventually I was sent to the Flight Instructors College in New Orleans, where all we did was teach accomplished pilots how to be good, better pilots and acrobatics. So most of my flying experience was just rolling around the sky doing aerobatics and seeing if I could tear an airplane apart. And although I went through various instrument training programs, I never liked flying on instruments and the company I flew for, we only flew on cloudless days, so the only kind of flying I ever enjoyed was acrobatics. And the rest of flying always bored me. It still does.
Because you were an instructor rather than kind of, as it were, out where the action was?
Yeah, yes.
Did you feel sort of, like you missed?
I did initially. But now I'm so happy that this, you know, I would have hated to go, think now that I either was killed or killed somebody.
Yeah.
You know, to me it was a blessing, and I learned to enjoy myself and the kind of flying I was doing. And of course, after the war, between World War II and Korea, there were no careers. I never knew anybody had a career. Everybody was looking for a job.
Absolutely.
And there weren't many jobs around. And I became a crop duster.
And where was that?
This was in New Jersey.
Upstate New Jersey.
I was flying out of Pennsylvania, but I was mostly in potato farms in New Jersey, flying an old rickety, overloaded airplane a foot off the ground.
And that was the job you could get?
Well, that's the job I got, yeah.
Okay.
And in those days, crop dusters, even if they had the money, couldn't be insured. And had I been killed back then, my wife wouldn't have had a penny.
Right.
Not take off in the dark, fly to, you know, just, you know, there'd be a light in the sky, but to fly to the potato fields in New Jersey, start dusting this high off the ground, flying between houses and barns and under wires and between trees, and do that until about 10 o'clock in the morning when the convection currents, because of the sun, wouldn't have let the dust adhere to the plant. And then they'd supply me with a pickup truck, and I'd go out and sell farmers on dusting jobs, and then in the afternoon my wind died down, I started dusting again until dark, and then in the dark I'd fly the airplane. I had no instruments other than altimeter and tachometer, that sort of thing, and generally I was no further than 50 miles from Philadelphia, and normally I could see a glow in the sky. I knew that was Philadelphia.
So that was your orientation?
The glow in the sky, and I would fly, head for the glow, and then when I get to this side of Philadelphia, I recognize a Philadelphia Electric sign, another sign that I knew at the time. I knew that somewhere in there was a field. And I used to leave a light bulb burning on the tool shed on the field. And generally in the evening, you know, I could see because it was not that dark or the moon was out, but sometimes it was really dark. I had actually come in and fly from the signs and look for that light and start feeling for the ground to my airplane, and pull up in the hangar, get the airplane in the hangar all by myself, and get up again at 4 o'clock in the morning and load the airplane, grease the rocker arms, load the truck, and take off before the truck did. Start dusting as soon as I'm. That was an awful job.
Hard work.
I should have been, yeah. And I no respirator, and the stuff we were using was dangerous, I know. It used to corrode the tail of the airplane.
What was it?
It was an old travel air with a 550 wasp engine in it.
Mm-hmm. Any idea what kind of stuff you were scattering?
I think it was DDT, which, you know, killed birds and people and everything.
Sure did. Now let's take a break.
All right.